Hello and welcome to the TA teleconference, Generating and Refining Research Ideas, Part 2, presented by Dr. Sonia Foss, Professor of Communication at the University of Colorado at Denver, and Dr. William Waters, an Assistant Professor of English at the University of Houston downtown. Sonia's research and teaching interests are in contemporary rhetorical theory and criticism, feminist perspectives on communication, the incorporation of marginalized voices into rhetorical theory and practice, and visual rhetoric. She is the author or co-author of the books Destination Dissertation, A Traveler's Guide to a Done Dissertation, Rhetorical Criticism, Contemporary Perspectives on Rhetoric, Inviting Transformation, Feminist Rhetorical Theories, and Women Speak. Her essays and communication journals have dealt with topics such as invitational rhetoric, agency in the film Run Lola Run, feminine spectatorship in Garrison Keillor's monologues, visual argumentation, and body art. Dr. Foss earned her PhD in communication studies from Northwestern University and previously taught at Ohio State University, the University of Oregon, the University of Denver, Virginia Tech, and Norfolk State University. William's research and teaching interests are in writing theory and practice, the history of the English language, linguistics, and modern grammar. He is the co-author of Destination Dissertation, A Traveler's Guide to a Done Dissertation, and was the managing editor of L'Operta, A Doorway into the Academy. He also has published several poems in national journals. William earned his PhD in language and linguistics from the University of New Mexico and previously taught at the University of Maine, University College of Galway, Ireland, and Chungbuk National University in Korea. Sonia and William present the TA-sponsored workshop Destination Dissertation, Practical Strategies for Writing the Thesis or Dissertation, and Sharing Results, Crafting an Article. They also offer individual coaching. They participated. They had done a recording of the first part of the teleconference. It's on the TA website, and the link will be included in the follow-up email. So I now turn the teleconference over to Sonia and William.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the two-part teleconference on generating and refining research ideas. And again, our thanks to TAA for sponsoring this and to Kim for handling all of the logistics. Again, I'd like to let you know a couple of format things before we begin. First, you'll see that you have an outline of the major ideas we're going to cover today, so you might want to just pay attention to that as we go through because it will help you keep track of where we are. And second, we're going to have lots of time at the end of this teleconference for questions, so we'd like it if you would just jot your questions down as they occur to you, and then we'll give you a chance to ask them at the end of the teleconference. So let's get started.
We're delighted that you've joined us again to hear us finish describing the steps in the process of generating research ideas. The idea that we're going to talk primarily about is the generative method. We're going to finish what we began last week. This is the method where the ideas are generated from a curious artifact that you encounter. As you recall, last week, we suggested five different methods for generating research ideas. First was starting with a question. The second was starting with literature. The third was using a conceptual conversation where you generate ideas in response to a partner who asks you questions. The fourth was using a promise file that you've been keeping. And the fifth was this method, the generative method, where your ideas for a research project are generated from a curious artifact that you or data that you've encountered.
Last time we talked about four of the steps in this generative method. The first was finding a curious text or data. The second was coding the data broadly to discover the major pieces that will lead to an explanation of that text or data. The third step was searching for an explanation that holds the pieces together and makes some kind of contribution to your discipline. And the fourth was developing and testing your explanatory schema. And now we're ready to complete the steps in the process, and there are four more.
The very next step in the process of generating ideas is to use your explanatory schema to create a solid research question. When you've constructed an explanatory schema that you believe provides an insightful explanation of your artifact, and it answers the questions that led you initially into the exploration of the artifact, you're ready to construct your research question. You want to be able to state clearly what your research question is, although, depending on the kind of article or chapter you're writing, you may state the research question as a thesis statement instead of actually writing it as a question. Use the principle behind the TV show Jeopardy to create a question for which the explanatory schema you've developed is the answer. For example, the explanatory schema we developed for Run Lola Run, the artifact that we talked about analyzing last week, is that the three runs in the film represent different agentic orientations. As a result of this schema, our research question became, what is the nature and function of agentic orientation? And by the way, just so this example makes more sense, by agency or agentic, we simply mean having influence or control over your world.
What are you aiming for as you create a question out of your explanatory schema? A good research question meets six criteria. The first criterion for a good research question is that it clearly identifies the theoretical construct you are studying. For example, if you're interested in figuring out the processes by which parents transmit their political perspectives to their children, the theoretical construct you are studying is transmission of political perspectives. If you're interested in whether or not grades motivate students' learning, your theoretical construct is students' motivation. If you're interested in how television networks attract and retain viewers through branding, your theoretical construct is branding. So notice that the theoretical construct is the phenomenon, event, or experience that you want to learn more about.
A second criterion that a research question should meet is that it should contain some suggestion of recognizability of the theoretical construct. Again, recognizability of the theoretical construct. This means that the research question articulates the theoretical construct in a specific enough way so that you'll know it when you see it in your data. In other words, it supplies a clear unit of analysis that allows you to tell the difference between that construct and other constructs that look maybe like it. To accomplish recognizability, word the construct in a way that is concrete and specific.
An example might help clarify this idea of recognizability. One doctoral student we were working with started planning her study with a theoretical construct of the experience of non-traditional women in college. So the experience of non-traditional women in college, she thought, was her theoretical construct. Well, this is too large because she would have a difficult time recognizing the construct when she sees it in her data. It involves a potentially large number of different constructs, including women's experiences of raising children while going to school, the degree of support that they receive from family members, the responses of other students to them, their educational accomplishments, their use of technology, the emotions that women experience, and on and on and on. There's virtually nothing having to do with non-traditional women college students that would not count as part of the construct of the experience of non-traditional women in college. So a more specific theoretical construct would be something like non-traditional women's experiences of discrimination in the classroom, or non-traditional women's use of support services on campus. So the recognizability here is that the theoretical construct is focused on one aspect of non-traditional women's experiences, and it allows this student to discriminate between it and other constructs that are a part of non-traditional women's experiences in college.
There's another criterion you want your research question to meet, and that is transcendence of data. Transcendence of data. Except in a few instances, and we'll talk about what these are shortly, your research question should not include mention of the specific data that you're using to investigate your question. Many different kinds of data can be used to answer your research question, so don't confine your question to the one type of data that you are studying. You want your question to be more abstract than those specific data. Let's look at an example where the criterion of transcendence of data was violated in a research question. We worked with a student who initially proposed as part of his research question a theoretical construct of accounting practices used in children's theater in Detroit. Here, his theoretical construct is the same as his data. He's conflating the construct in the research question with the data he'll use to answer the question. As a result, his story has limited interest to other readers who are not interested in children's theater in Detroit. He certainly could collect data for his study concerning accounting practices in children's theater groups in Detroit, but the construct he wants to understand in his larger study, the construct he wants to understand in his study is larger than that, perhaps something like accounting practices in nonprofit art organizations.
Now, there are a few kinds of studies where the criterion of transcendence of data in the research question doesn't apply. And these are studies in which researchers want to find out about a particular phenomenon. So the research is specifically about that phenomenon. For example, someone who's interested in the strategies used by Alcoholics Anonymous to attract members would want to include Alcoholics Anonymous in the research question. In this case, the researcher sees something unique and significant about that particular organization in contrast to other treatment approaches and sets out to understand it specifically. There are some fields, too, where the data are typically included in the research question. History is one. Studies in this field are about a particular place and time, and their purpose is to explore that place and time. So those particulars are included in the theoretical construct of the research question. For example, a research question for a history study might be, how was a counterculture identity sustained in Humboldt County, California in the 1980s? The discipline of English is another field where research questions may include mention of data. Scholars in English are often interested in a writer or a group of writers or a particular type of literature, and those would be included in the research question. So an example is, how do troll images function in the narratives of Scandinavian writers between 1960 and 1990?
Actually, I'd like to know how those troll images function. Your research question also should meet the criterion of identifying your study's contribution to an understanding of the theoretical construct. Your research question should name what happens to the theoretical construct in your study, what you are doing with it in your study, or what interests you about it. This contribution should be developed from the theoretical conversations in your discipline and should reflect a specialized knowledge of your discipline. For example, the new contribution you might be making is to begin to suggest the communication processes by which political beliefs are transmitted within families. You know that such beliefs, the theoretical construct, get transmitted. Your new contribution will be to explain some of the processes by which the transmission happens. Or let's say your theoretical construct is stay-at-home mothers. The new contribution you might make is to explain how stay-at-home mothers legitimize the role in an era where most women work. Meeting this criterion in your research question, forecast the contributions to the discipline you'll discuss in your conclusion.
A fifth criterion that your research question should meet is capacity to surprise. You should not already know the answer to the research question you're asking. You want to be surprised by what you find out. If you already know the answer to your question, you don't need to do the study. And moreover, if you know the answer already, you aren't really doing research. Instead, you are selecting and coding data to report on and advocate for a position that you already hold. We worked with someone who had selected as her data immigrant narratives, and she had as her research question, how do traumatic events produce long-term negative effects on individuals? So she was already assuming that immigration inevitably traumatizes individuals and that there are no possibilities other than to experience immigration negatively. She was not likely to be surprised by her findings, because her question articulated what she was expecting to discover. If she continued in this direction, she certainly could have found examples of negative effects, but her contribution to her discipline and her future ability to publish would have been greatly diminished.
A final criterion for judging a research question is robustness, the capacity to generate complex results. Your question should have the capacity to produce multiple insights about various aspects of the theoretical construct you're exploring. It should not be a question to which the answer is yes or no, because such an answer is not a complex result. Research questions that typically produce robust findings often begin with phrases like this. What is the nature of? What are the functions of? What are the mechanisms by which? What factors affect? What are the effects of? What is the relationship between?
When you are formulating your research question, then, work carefully on wording it so that the question meets the 6 criteria for a good research question. It clearly identifies the theoretical construct you are studying. It contains some suggestion of recognizability of the theoretical construct. It usually transcends your data. It identifies your study's contribution to an understanding of the theoretical construct. It has a capacity to surprise, and it can produce robust results. A question formulated according to these criteria ensures that your study has a solid center that can hold all of its pieces together.
You've undoubtedly seen journal articles in which there is more than one research question. Should you have more than one research question then? Maybe, but we discourage it, and here's why. In some cases, studies contain more than one question because researchers haven't thought out carefully enough about what they want to find out. As a result, they take a scattershot approach and try to get close to the question they want to answer by really asking a whole bunch of questions, asking about many, many different things. A better approach is to aim for one research question and to think carefully about what it is. Refine it sufficiently so that it really gets the key thing that you want to find out about. All research designs have one central question that is guiding them, and taking the time to figure out precisely what that is will make your study hold together better.
Another reason that studies sometimes include many research questions is because students confuse research questions with the questions they will use as prompts for coding their data. The many research questions are really just guides for coding data. In a study about online chat rooms and how they develop deep culture, one woman we worked with had a list of research questions that included these 4. What artifacts do chat rooms use as the basis for developing culture? What norms characterize chat rooms? What processes are used to socialize new members into chat rooms? And what mechanisms are used in chat rooms to repair breaches of organizational norms? Well, these questions are not separate research questions as much as they are questions that she will use to guide her analysis of her data. They are methodological guidelines that will help her know what to look for as she codes her data. So she really just has the one research question, which is, how do chat rooms develop deep culture? Remember that a research question is what the study is about. It produces the title of the article or the chapter or the book. Well, none of these 4 minor questions is major enough to assume that role in this study, so they aren't really research questions for her.
There are some cases when more than one research question is warranted. When a study has more than one research question, it tends to be a situation when basic information about a theoretical construct doesn't exist already in the literature, and you need to know basic information before you can investigate a process that categorizes that construct. The woman that Sonia just mentioned doing the study on deep culture, for example, knew from the literature she had read that online interaction is not supposed to have the capacity to develop a deep culture, the way that organizations typically do. But she had been observing and participating in a chat room that she thought had such a culture. One question she wanted to ask then was, can chat rooms develop deep culture? She didn't know whether or not chat rooms can have this feature, this kind of culture, and she wanted to find that out. The answer to this question alone, though, doesn't meet the criterion of robustness that we talked about above, because it would produce only an answer of yes, chat rooms can have deep culture, or no, they can't. That finding is not complex enough for a study. So she needs another question in addition to the question about whether chat rooms can develop deep culture. She needs something that would produce more complex findings. She also wanted to find out how participants in chat rooms create deep culture, if in fact they do. So she had a second research question for her study. What mechanisms do participants in chat rooms use to create deep culture? Because she needed to validate that these kinds of interactions have a viable culture before she could ask how this culture is created, her study had two research questions.
After you have your research question developed, you'll move on to the next step of the process, and that is to code your artifact again using the elements of your explanatory schema. Now, you are doing more in-depth coding here than what you did originally because you are now testing your proposed schema against the data of your artifact, and you are refining your schema. Your research question now guides your coding, so as you analyze the artifact, you are looking for dimensions and qualities pertinent to answering it. And in that initial coding process, you are identifying features of the artifact and interpreting them.
When you finish the detailed coding of your artifact, make another copy of your observations or coding. You're going to need this. Save one copy of the coded artifact for future reference. So just put it aside and you'll come back to it later. Physically cut apart the notes or codes on the other copy, on the second copy that you've made. In a process much like the one you might have used in your initial coding of the artifact, sort the coded data into piles according to topics. Put all the strips of paper that you have that have to do with the same topic together into one pile. And to sort these, you might just look at them and say, are they similar or are they different? Once you've started making piles, label the piles with a word or phrase that describes what is common to all the observations in that pile. If you can, create a space where you can lay out the piles and keep them out while you're writing your essay. So find a big table or a countertop or something. If you don't have this kind of space, put the piles into separate envelopes and label the envelopes with the labels that you put on the piles.
The next step is to go to your computer and type a list of the labels that are on the piles. So each of these piles representing parts of your explanatory schema that you are now refining has a label on it. So I want you to type just a list of those labels and then take your scissors and cut those labels on that list apart and then lay those out on a table or the desk in front of you and play around with them to figure out, okay, now how do they relate to each other? How do I want to organize them? How do they provide the explanation that is the answer to my research question? Now, you already did this to some extent earlier because you've got a basic explanatory schema. But now, as you are working to discover what is subordinate to what are the overarching categories, you are really developing and refining the explanatory schema that you've seen now up until now only in general terms. So you're working out the kinks. You're conceptualizing aspects of it you didn't think through before. You're refining it, and you're extending it.
When you have your explanatory schema fully developed, and you know how the concepts captured by the piles of strips of paper are going to work together in your schema, create the actual labels you'll use to name the various components of your schema. Choose these conceptual labels carefully, because the components of your schema become the concepts of your theory and the subheadings in the body of your essay. If possible, name the components with labels that are original and not conventional. Labels that don't come from existing literature. Clearly, if some part of your schema is a well-known process with a known label, you want to use that label. But not everything in your schema should repeat what is already known. If you have new observations and insights, they should produce new labels.
Make your labels parallel with one another and at the same level of abstraction, because this will make the theory that you've just developed that comes from your explanatory schema, it will make it coherent. So the labels that we gave to the three agentic orientations that Lola adopts in the film Run, Lola, Run were victim, supplicant, and director. Although these are common words, they haven't been used before to describe options in terms of agency. So they're new in that no theory we know about puts them together in this way. And also notice that these three words are parallel. They're the same kinds of words, and that they're at the same level of abstraction.
When you have an explanatory schema that explains your artifact in comprehensive and insightful ways, do a miniature literature review of the key concepts of that schema. The purpose for the literature review at this stage is to relate the literature to your explanatory schema so that you can enter conversations in your field about the ideas covered by that schema. See if literature exists that can help you elaborate on ideas in your schema. See if there's literature that points you to ways in which you can elaborate on an existing theory, or that makes visible a point of contention where you take issue in a way in which a construct is conceptualized. You are checking concepts and relationships from the literature against your actual data. At this point, you're looking for evidence of whether or not those concepts and relationships apply to the artifact you are analyzing, and, if so, the form that they take in your artifact. In the case of our analysis of Run, Lola, Run, we reviewed literature on various options by which agency is constructed in rhetorical performances, including the origins of agency, various forms that agency can assume, and the strategies employed by specific agents in response to particular situations.
Searching the literature in this way is probably a different way to use literature from the way to which you're accustomed, where you do a literature review at the start of your study to help you design the study. When you're doing original scholarship, new ideas should emerge that neither you nor anyone else has thought about previously. If you go and review all relevant literature before you analyze your artifact, you will be so steeped in the literature that your creative ideas will be constrained and stifled. Because discovery of new ideas is your purpose, you don't want to have knowledge of all the categories relevant to your theory at the beginning of your analysis. Only after a topic has emerged as pertinent to a possible explanation for your artifact do you want to go back to the literature to see if this topic has been studied, and if so, what others have said about it.
You may find yourself facing two common problems when you surveyed the literature at this point. One is that the literature seems overwhelming because there's so much of it to cover and that you have no idea how to begin. A second problem is keeping track of everything you read so that you can make use of it efficiently or effectively. You may find that you have highlighted passages or have stuck post-it notes on virtually every page of every book and article that you have relevant to your subject. We have a system of coding literature that addresses these problems and enables you to engage the literature in an efficient and manageable fashion. We gave a TAA conference on this, a teleconference on this topic, so if you're interested in learning more about how to more efficiently manage code and manage literature, you can access that on the TAA website. We also have a detailed chapter on this in our book, Destination Dissertation.
The last step of analysis before you begin to write your article or your chapter is to decide how to frame your explanatory schema so that it can contribute to a significant conversation in your discipline. Now, your research question may explicitly suggest what this frame is, but in many cases, you can contribute to numerous theoretical conversations with the same research question. Let's say your research question asks how political leaders justify unpopular wars. Well, you could frame your essay as a contribution to an understanding of political discourse, to an understanding of discourse around war, or to an understanding of the communication process of justification. In the case of our analysis of Run Lola Run, we framed our explanatory schema in terms of the relationship between communication and agency. And we suggested that one piece of that relationship is under-theorized and not adequately explained. And that is, what are the various options for an acting agency and how do those different options affect outcomes? But we also could have framed our essay, for example, in terms of communication between marginalized and dominant groups and means for gaining access to the resources of the dominant culture.
Framing the study is the last step in the generative method of developing and refining an idea for a research project. Now, of course, is the point at which you're ready to write your research project up. And we've also done a TAA teleconference on writing and editing. Again, if you're interested in those ideas, you can look that up on the website. And once again, there's also a chapter on this in our book.
We're now at the end of what we have to say about generating and refining research ideas. So to summarize, we've suggested five methods for coming up with ideas for research projects. The first is to start with a question. The second is starting with literature. The third method is using a conceptual conversation where you generate ideas in response to a partner who asks you questions. The fourth is keeping a promise file, ideas and questions that come to you as you were doing something else, that you file away and promise yourself you'll come back to them later. And then the fifth one is the one we've spent the most time on, and it's the generative method, where your idea for a research project is generated from a curious artifact or data that you encounter. So does anyone have any questions about these five methods or the four steps that we just went through?
Remember to press 4-star to unmute yourself to ask a question.
Yes, I do have a question.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
This is Veronica Watson. I was wondering if you could talk a little more about the distinctions between the research review, sort of the lit review that you do at the beginning of the process, and then the one that you described today at the end of the process. They seemed, well, the one that you discussed today was very clear in that it's focused on the sort of the research schema that you have developed for your study. I'm wondering now what that earlier stage was. I guess I didn't catch it very well in my notes.
That's actually a great question. We normally, when we first started thinking about this, only had the last research review of the literature in the last place. But the first one is really just to make sure that no one else has done what you've done, and so that you don't spend a long time working on a schema and then finding out, ooh, you know, this has really been covered a lot.
Yeah, okay. That's simple. Thank you.
And usually, too, you would probably not be working in an area that you didn't have some acquaintance with. So if you encounter this artifact, it gets you thinking about things. You go through this process, you develop this explanatory schema. It's unlikely that that would be so totally unconnected to anything you'd ever read or anything you'd ever studied in your discipline. So in one sense, too, that initial lit review is the studying that you've been doing, the literature you've been reading, just as part of your normal scholarship. So all of that is, in a sense, serving as a context for you as you develop new explanatory schemas. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yes, it does.
More than anything else, we put it in as a safety valve.
Other questions?
The second part was much easier, actually, conceptually, than the first part. So I'm not sure that there'll be that many more questions, but we did go over rather quickly if there's people want more detail on things.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You just had a follow-up to the last one. The question was about the first literature review,
mm-hmm.
and I actually didn't get that in my notes. Is that step three that you're referring to there, the searching for an explanation?
Yeah, it's actually not part of the regular process of the generative method. We talked about it as one method of
coming. Oh, method number two, starting
exactly,
with the literature.
Exactly. But I think that earlier caller, though, was raising a good point about that there should be some kind of grounding in the literature before you start the generative process.
Oh, okay. All right.
So we really didn't talk about that as part of the generative process. But she's right that there should be something there.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that clarification.
Sure.
This has been an educational presentation brought to you by the Text and Academic Authors Association.